All right, let's do this. Peanut, if you're staying in the room, no talking. Hello, and welcome to the Photo Work Podcast, the talky and touchy-feely version of my book, Photo Work, 40 Photographers on Process and Practice. Hello, everyone. I'm Sasha Wolf, recording for probably the very last time from the Airstream in Woodstock, New York.
Now I'm sad.
I got a little sad when I said that.
I know.
But it's okay. There's a house on the horizon.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm joined as usual.
I don't even wait anymore.
I know. You're like, she might not actually say my name, so I better just jump in. I'm joined as usual by my traveling companion.
Yeah.
Mr. Michael Montana. Chauvin.
I'm changing my middle name now.
By the way, you don't even need Chauvin Dalton. You could just be Michael Montana.
Michael Montana. Holy cow.
Yeah, we've been on a walkabout together.
I know. It was 8 days in Chico Hot Springs for the Chico Review. A very intense week together, and we had a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, hold on a second. An intense week together. I mean, it. What are you trying to say?
I'm talking about the review.
Yeah. Okay. The work part. Yeah. Yes. We're out of work. I was thinking that one thing that was so nice is that we got to meet, which happens when we travel together, we got to meet a lot of our listeners, people who listen to the podcast. And that was really fun. I mean, I was thinking that, you know, conservatively, I would say 75 to 80% of the listeners that we met found out that I'm not nearly as fun in person. But, you know, but looking on the bright side, because I am by nature a glass half full type of gal, they found out that you're the fun one.
I don't think that's all true, exactly true, I think.
No, it is, but it's okay. I'm not a group person. I've said that before. I think I talk about it actually in this episode a little, which we'll get to the episode in a second. But I'm a one person, two people, three people, you know, thruply, even quadruply. I can stretch to a like Cinco de Mayo-y type
There's five around the dinner table, yes.
Yeah. And then my brain explodes. So I think there was a lot of really lovely people coming up. I just want to apologize to everyone who came up and said something really nice to me and got a response that was somewhere in the realm of me looking down at my feet and mumbling something that may or may not have sounded like thank you. But it was thank you.
You do not handle compliments well.
Listen, but yeah, dorky, somewhere between embarrassed and overwhelmed. I don't know. But you, Michael Chauvin Dalton, you were the life of the party, man. You were the life of, in fact, they give out awards. They're sort of fake awards, but they give out awards like person who reviewer who crushed the most dreams during the week.
Neither of us got that award. No.
No, I would not get that award. But there was a best laugh, and you didn't get it. And I wanted to file a complaint.
I thought they had invented that award because I was there.
Me too. So. That's what I thought. And everyone who I was sitting with felt the same way. People were, filing motions.
As a recount.
Right. We wanted a recount. Okay. dialing it in for a second. So yeah, we have a really fun show because, oh, I just want to say one other thing. Sorry. I am getting ready to move into a house, which I alluded to at the top of the show. So my brain is a little scrambled. I'm probably 10 days away from moving and coming down the home stretch of renovations and running back and forth between the Airstream and my new place, which is 5 minutes away. So everything's very chaotic. I'm half packed. You know, it's chaos.
I think half packed is a great description of your state of mind.
Yes. Yeah. That. Where's the drum? We need the drum set. I know somewhere on my keyboard, if I hit a certain button,
you could get a rim shot. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know which one it is. I'm scared. No, you know what? I want to say that you were doing a lot of recording at Chico for your show, Real Photo Show. So I just want people to tune into Real Photo Show and
hear
Michael's interviews with a lot of great artists who were at Chico.
Well, they got to hear Ray Meeks on both our shows.
Yep.
So that was just that's just the beginning. There are a lot of recordings. There's a lot of work in front of me.
I know you are a busy bee. But thank you for, you know, also filling in for me. And I have been sort of, you know, really buried in getting a mortgage.
And there's big things happening at CPW and all of us. And so there's a lot of good stuff coming.
There's a lot going on. By the way, the reason we're not at CPW as usual recording is for a good reason. CPW is getting ready to start a huge renovation on their big old factory space that they're moving into. And that's where our recording studio has been. And we moved all our equipment out. So for the next however long, I'll probably be recording at the new space. So that's what's going on there. But CPW continues to just grow and do amazing things. Mm-hmm. And we're really thrilled to continue our relationship with them as well. So.
Absolutely.
Okay, so our guest today is the photographer, the book publisher, and the founder and director of Chico Review, Jesse Lenz. So it was super fun to have him on. And actually, it's funny, we didn't interview him while we were in Montana for the Chico Review event. Jesse was coming through town here, and you came up the other day, and we talked to Jesse up here. Because while I was there, I was reviewing work all day, so I didn't have time to record.
I don't think Jesse had time either.
No, Jesse wouldn't have had time either. He is the maestro. Never seen anyone so busy. Anyway, so that's who our guest is. But, you know, before we even get to that, I'm so sorry I'm not looking at the script that doesn't actually exist. But
script.
You missed my air quotes. Yes. Are there some announcements to make before we dive in?
Yes, of course. Our sponsor, Picture House in the Small Darkroom, has one more event for April, and then we'll get to May events before our next recording. But Tim Carpenter and Charlie Simakaitis will be doing a joint signing on Wednesday, April 24th. Tim's new book with the Ice Plant is called Little. Charlie Simakaitis is releasing his debut book with TIS called The Crisis Tapes. And these two artists will be in conversation during the event. So that's April 24th. And the time for that is 6 p.m. Also, let's not forget that Picture House and the Small Darkroom is a lab, is a fantastic lab and a post-production studio. And, you know, anything you need to do.
Work.
Yeah. You should check them out for, including their mini lab prints and everything else. So,
yeah, no, they're really, it's a phenomenal facility. So yes, people, please reach out to them for post-production services. If we didn't feel that way about them, we would not have this relationship with them. I mean,
yeah,
I hope that goes without saying. Also, by the way, April 24th is right before APAD, the Association of International Photography Art Dealers Art Fair, which I hope people, I'm not going to have a booth there this year, but I'll be wandering around. You'll be wandering around.
Yep.
We'll be hanging out. Lots going on right around that time. Yeah, so great show. Jesse is a ball of energy. He's just really an amazing person. The guy has 6 kids, first of all, and manages to get more work done than anyone I know. So really impressive person. But it was really fun to talk with him.
Yeah. And just so people know, they may hear an occasional muffled laugh from me. I was actually in the room. We were recording all together.
Yeah, you were.
And I really enjoyed this. Jesse reveals sort of a lot of interesting ways he thinks about photography, because he does edit and publish, and he is a photographer, and he's also a filmmaker. And he talks about these sort of strategies, these ideas that involve filmmaking, the idea of his children as actors and making a mm-hmm. film, the idea of looking at B-roll as a sort of strategy when he's editing books for others, you know, thinking mm-hmm. of it as like someone who's just been photographing, and within all of this material, there is this idea, there is this story to be told. And I really like the way he thinks about photography as a sort of filmmaking venture.
Yeah, no, that was really interesting and something I didn't know, and really fun to talk about. Always interested in the way people sort of think about cinema, or the people who do think about cinema and narrative and whatnot is something that really interests me. So before we give the whole show away, Michael, if you don't mind, please take it away.
My pleasure. And here is your conversation with Jesse Lenz.
Jesse Lenz, welcome to the PhotoWork podcast. It's great to have you here, and I'm about to crack up because you're looking at me funny. For the audience, Jesse and I are recording together in person, and MCD is also here. So a full house at our wonderful...
I like that. It's like a DJ name. We're about to get real intimate in this space.
In our wonderful recording studio at Center for Photography, Woodstock. Anyway, Jesse Lenz, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, this is awesome. Thanks for doing it.
So as you know, we start every episode with the artist's guest's biography. So if you could tell us about yourself, and I'm going to do a like, do, 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 do.
Yeah.
So we'll try and, because we have a ton to cover. So.
Yeah. I was born in Montana, Glendive, which is kind of the worst part of Montana. It's like basically North Dakota is just dirt and rattlesnakes. I have a kind of an ongoing theme in my life where I'm always living in kind of the worst versions of each place I live in. But I was born there. My dad was a pastor and a missionary. So when I was like 5 or 6, we moved to Latvia about 6 months after they declared independence from the Soviet Union. Moved there in the winter, pretty much without knowing anybody. So lived there for a few years. My dad was actually, he was like the home church pastor of a bunch of Nigerian Ethiopian work immigrants. So we were like in the Soviet Union, surrounded by Africans who all spoke amazing English.
Wow.
From there, ended up in the States, ended up going to like middle school, high school in West Virginia. Then went to like the smallest, cheapest state school in West Virginia and met my wife there, and ended up going to Frederick, Maryland. Kind of moved around a bit, ended up back in West Virginia because we started having kids and we wanted to be close to family. Then we were like, that sucks. We got to get out of here. So we sold our house, bought an Airstream, and traveled North America with our first 3 kids for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. And then ended up where my wife is from in Ohio, and been there for the past, I think, almost 8 years.
And added more children.
Yeah, yeah. 3 more. You know, just felt we should double it now that we're not living in 30 feet of space.
Yeah, I like when you said our first 3 children. Our first 36 kids.
Yeah.
So that was extremely quick, which we appreciate because we have a lot to talk about. So you and I were just hanging out together.
Yeah.
In Montana, because you are the director, founder of the Chico Hot Springs Portfolio Review.
Yeah.
And is that the name?
It's evolved. Yeah. So it started off as that when we first started it, because it was actually, I started the event before Charcoal. So it was just the Chico Review, Chico Hot Springs Portfolio Review. Then over the years, it's been shortened to just the Chico Review because it's not, I mean, as you know, it's like, it's not just a portfolio
that's
review.
Why I, yeah. That's actually where I got
yeah.
hung up.
Yeah,
I was like, wait, the whole first half of every day is artist talks.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of, I feel like originally we called it a portfolio showcase instead of a portfolio review. And I just got to the point, I was like, well, I like the idea of it being the Chico Review because really it is about reviewing your work, reviewing your life. It's about a lot of these things. And I like it being centralized to that place because that place is the whole reason why I built it. And so, yeah, it's evolved over the years. And I've tried to, the branding, we've changed it a few different times to being like the photo book retreats because I think retreat's almost the closest word defined for it. But we're always trying to figure out like, exactly is it? It's
very
weird.
Campy.
It is.
And I don't mean campy.
Right.
Okay. So I want to talk a lot about that, but I'd like to start with your work as an artist.
Yeah.
So you are a wonderful artist. You have such a high profile as a publisher and as the person who founded Chico Review and, you know, is hesitating there for a second because it's such like, it's so trippy to me because that you pull this off really because as someone who comes from a film and TV background, it is such a big production. Like people don't realize there are so many moving parts. And when I was saying like founded, it's like, it's crazy. It's like being a ringmaster of a million, you know.
Yeah,
like,
professional cat wrangler.
Yeah. You have such an interesting sort of evolution because you were an illustrator, which I really didn't know about and I'd like to hear about, but wonderful photographer who, of course, has the most perfect last name, Lens. But, you know, I've spent a whole bunch of time over the past 10 days, 2 weeks, however long we've been back from Chico. With your two monographs. And so I really, really want to focus on them for this part of the conversation.
Awesome.
So why don't you tell folks in your words about these two books that I've been looking at?
Yeah. So the first two books, the Locust and the Seraphim, I say first two because this is an ongoing series. So you know, the work really started when we moved to Ohio. When we moved there after being on the road, I was actually closing down the magazine I used to run called The Collective Quarterly. And moving to Ohio for me was kind of a big failure. One of the reasons we were on the road was because I wanted to find a place that we felt like we belonged. You know, never really having roots, I never had a reason to be anywhere. So, you know, I always wanted to move back out west or go to the Pacific Northwest or out to Maine or something like that. And when we were traveling, we just realized that we never felt at home anywhere. And we ended up buying the house that my wife grew up in that her family built. And I had, when we left on the road, I remember driving out of Ohio saying, man, I will never fucking live in Ohio and I won't live like 1,000 miles from my in-laws. And now we live across the street in Ohio. And so be careful what you say. But, you know, for me, like moving there, it was a really big defeat because my work up until that time had always been about traveling and like going to Newfoundland and photographing seabirds and, you know, traveling and finding these like weird communities out in the middle of nowhere. And I remember there was a point, it was actually, there was one picture in the first book. It was a vertical portrait of my son in a Batman costume with a couple kids in the background. And when I took that picture, that was the first picture I ever took in Ohio of my kids that made me realize I could make the kind of work I wanted to make in my backyard with my kids. Because up until then, I'd always photographed my kids because I'm a photographer, but never seriously. Like, I hated work about people's kids. I always thought it was just like uninteresting. I remember taking that picture and really looking at it, then talking to my good friend, John Levitt, because he was who I was traveling with a lot. And I remember him telling me, he's like, hey man, like you're not playing the hand you're being dealt. You have this awesome, beautiful family. You live in this place that has a long tradition of like interesting photos. Like the Midwest has like not been photographed that much by a lot of really great American photographers. And like, there's a whole history of, you know, Eastern European photographers that have the same landscape. He's like, you're in a place that I would kill to be. But you're trying to do what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time in that body of work that I realized that. And so this whole kind of body of work has been my way of trying to find a way to like see the place I live as a movie I would want to watch. Mm-hmm. It's a way of seeing the bits and fragments of magic that I feel are really special and realizing that I am surrounded by things I love, even if it wasn't the place I wanted to be. And it's kind of just that aspect of like trying to find beauty and intrigue in places that you kind of are stuck within, like boundaries. Like I really need a box to be in to be my most creative self. Like I can't really start with a blank canvas. I mean, that's goes back to being an illustrator, being a collage illustrator. Like I need something to react to. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the first two books have just been this ongoing kind of reaction to the place and finding the things that make me feel alive and really make me feel like the world is enchanted around me. And mm-hmm. I think having kids and all this is like, I realize that like, I want to try to get back to that level of like childhood enchantment and not like childhood innocence, but like this idea of being fascinated with the world around you mm-hmm. and not being jaded. Like I think children, if you want to think about like innocence of children, I think that like children, they're not innocent, but they're like impervious to the imperfection of the world. So like,
also things are new to them, right?
Yeah, so totally. It's like, it comes naturally for you to be interested.
It's exciting when they see exactly. things because they may have only seen it either never yep. or once or twice or three times in their life.
Totally.
Whereas, you know, we take things for granted because we're used to them.
Yeah. And humans, that's like a superpower. Mm-hmm. Like we can take things for granted so that we can focus on other things mm-hmm. that are more important to staying alive in yeah, our life.
That's true.
But yeah. like, you know, being, you know, like that's the beautiful thing about poetry and, you know, art is that you can kind of rediscover that absolutely. Enchantment again.
Yeah. Yeah. Making, you know, elevating the ordinary or the commonplace.
Yeah.
So the first book, which you did 3 years ago or four
that
years
released
ago?
In 2020. So yeah, four years ago. Yeah.
The Locusts. I wanted to ask you about, first of all, the work is very, very beautiful.
Thank you.
And really in a sort of, you know, it's black and white just to give people who aren't looking at the work. It's black and white. It's, you know, sort of in the tradition of, I would say, Emmett Gowan. Mm-hmm. I think I was reading someone, you know, throwing out Sally Mann, which I don't really see, but,
yeah.
you know.
Any work with kids in black and white, right, throw exactly. Sally out there.
to me, it sort of more has that looseness of like John Gossage.
Yeah. And my influences were heavily like Masaya Yamamoto, mm-hmm. like a lot of like Asian photographers mm-hmm. that are specifically more connected to nature than mm-hmm. a lot of the American photographers, mm-hmm. especially working with small cameras. That's, right. you know, that's yeah. a lot of those or even like Michael Ackerman or these different mm-hmm. people that are working with film and movie and kind of all these different things. Because, I mean, for me, my everyday can get so boring if I'm using one camera.
Right. Like, so you know. Use different cameras.
Yeah, I have a whole table full of cameras always loaded. And it's kind of a decision that you can kind of make that day of just like, well, what camera do I want to carry around or do I want to carry around a couple of them?
Oh, that's interesting. So there's sort of some way in which, you know, I mean, I know people obviously have very personal and deep relationships with their equipment. I know people for whom, you know, who shoot mostly with 35 and don't even have to look through the,
yeah.
you know, viewfinder. It's,
yeah.
it's an extension of their arm. But it sounds to me like, it sounds almost like you have a sort of loose, almost instinctual sort of relationship with, I'm going to pick this up today or yeah. I'm feeling this.
Yeah.
Or,
and for me, so much of it has to do with like what I want to do. Like it's always Tri-X film, push two stops. It's always black and white. It's always roll film. Like mm-hmm. I don't fuck with sheet film. Mm-hmm. Like I hate it. Mm-hmm. And I can't really use a tripod because like my subject just move around right. too much,
yeah.
you know, but it's really interesting because I think Todd Heidler told me, I think it was him who said it was like, first time I met him, one of our first Chicos, he told me that if you want to see the world different, change your apparatus. And I thought that was really good because for a while I was using the same kind of basic cameras, just some mm-hmm. Leicas and stuff. And there's just certain things you can't do with them.
Right.
I remember when yeah. I got a Rolleiflex for the first time and those bayonet attachments so you can focus really close. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I started photographing insects.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed. That was during the Locust.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I remember I photographed a praying mantis for the first time. I was like, oh, these are the monsters in my movie. Like I realized like I had this whole tiny world that I'd never been able to photograph because all my cameras, you had to be 3 feet away to photograph
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden I had this equipment that could get me these other characters in my play
mm-hmm.
That I could never have before. So mm-hmm. ever since then, just like every year, I always like, if I get excited about a new thing, like I'll get it and play with it. You know, the last couple of years I've been shooting 16 millimeter footage And Bolex's, and that's been amazing because now I've been making films.
Right, you're talking about moving pictures.
Yeah, then also using stills in the in it. So it's just like it for me. It just gives me something new because my subject matter is just the same every day. Like if it happens once, it's going to happen that same way over the next 15 days before the kid stops doing it. You know, so a lot of times it's like, well, you know, what does it look like outside today? If I know I'm going to have my little kids with me, I need to have a really wide camera with a really wide lens because I can only let go of their hand and be like a foot away. I can't be five steps back, you know? So it's just really practical things that dictate what you're carrying with you that day. Yeah. You know, are you going to have a kid on a backpack when you're hiking through the woods? I'm not going to take a big lens with me and look for owls because I'm not going to carry everything.
Yeah. This is such a conversation with a guest with six children.
Yeah. Prioritizing your kit based on how many kids you have to carry.
I love it. I think, it's awesome. So I want to talk to you a little bit about, did you do all the editing and sequencing yourself for your books?
Okay. Yeah.
So I want to ask you about that because I think that there's something, I don't know if it's, in some ways I could see it being, you know, less challenging as the artist to sequence the type of work you're making, because it, a little bit like in the Ray Meek sort of space, like I could see just getting into a really, really intuitive place and just letting the poetry sort of roll and feeling it. But at the same time, because there's a lot of repetition in the subject matter, because you are dealing with a very restricted geography, your backyard more or less, with some pictures inside your home, but not many. I could also see it being insanely challenging. So, but I wanted to ask you that in The Locust, the first three pictures, there is a sort of establishing shot.
Trying to remember what those three pictures are.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, I don't have.
No, it's all right. I'll remember. Yeah.
There's an establishing shot of.
Oh, yeah, the garden.
The garden.
Yeah.
And it's very, it's sort of Eden.
Yeah.
You know, except you include a man-made fence. Mm-hmm. In the picture along the left side of the image. So it very much signals that we're in a domestic sort of setting. Then there's an image of an X-ray.
Yeah, broken collarbone.
Broken collarbone. And then there it goes to a picture of one of your sons.
Yeah, the dead raccoons.
Yeah, with the dead raccoons. So I wonder if you could just take those three pictures and talk to me about, you know, what they meant to you and how
you know, so much of the editing is intuitive. It's, I think it's hard to edit your own work. I think if I wasn't doing so much editing that's not my work, it'd be even harder. You know, before I started Charcoal, I'd been editing a photographer, like a magazine, a 200 page magazine for 7 or 8 years working with my work and other people. So get really in the groove of cutting things that don't work. Mm-hmm. And I'm very ruthless when it comes to cutting, like ask anyone that we've published, like we can have some knockdown drag out fights about it. But even within that, like I do constantly kind of submit myself to other people that I really respect, like having that core group of peers that really respect your work and looking through edits. And, you know, I remember Stephen King in his book On Writing, which I think is like the best book that's not about photography that covers everything photographers need to know. He talks about when people edit your work that, you know, if all five of your ideal readers tell you have a problem, then you have a problem. If it's split 50-50, then you get to choose which one you want to do. But I think it's a really good way of realizing it, because that's kind of how all of it works. So, you know, with those, you know, that initial sequence, a lot of times with The Locust, I kind of established that I wanted the sequence to always follow the cycles of nature. So I wanted it to follow the seasons. So it was really kind of like just looking at the body of work for a long time and like, where does it feel like it starts for me? You know, like so much of it was kind of, it's kind of early discovery of the world around me. I was like, well, it makes sense for it to start kind of in an Eden-esque place. And I kind of had that picture of the garden, and there's always something about it that I really loved, but I didn't know what. I didn't even really like the idea of the image. And that's where a lot of my work is, like, it's just an image that gets stuck in my head and won't leave for, you know, months and months after looking at it. So, you know, I didn't have that one there originally, and it just, I knew I wanted to start with the X-ray, and then, you know, my son Howard with the raccoons. I felt like that set the atmospheric tone that I wanted. It, like, set it like a Bergman film, and like, that's where I want to start. But having this kind of like interlude of like almost like the fall of man or something, you know, my dad was a pastor, so I'm very heavily influenced by, you know, like kind of biblical mythology. It felt right. It felt right to start in this kind of like beautiful place, but you see those fences, you see that kind of separation between domestic and nature. Mm-hmm. And that was really what I was starting to tackle within my own life. So it was like, it just felt like the right thing to do.
No, I really love that. Yeah. I really appreciated it. One other thing, just, I'm not going to go too far down this path because it's not fair to the listeners who don't have the book in front of them, but I just want to ask you about, it's 13 pictures in before we get to an interior shot. Mm-hmm. It's like the screened-in porch, so I don't even know if that counts. Yeah. But how do you tackle, there are very few interior shots in the book.
Yeah.
In fact, there's some that don't even qualify.
Yeah.
won't get into that. But, you know, how did you handle that? Because I would think that if I was working on this project with you, that would have been a tough nut to crack there. Yeah. Because it is so much about the things we've been talking about. It's about nature and your children in nature and them sort of growing and living side by side with the natural world, but in a domesticated space to the extent that they're somewhat safe and cared for. But it definitely is tricky when we come inside.
Yeah.
So how did you think about that?
It was really tricky. I mean, it started out like I just don't really think my house is interesting photogenically. I always was like looking around these Amish houses, these Swartz and Truber, and they all look like Andrew Wyeth paintings. Uh-huh. I was like, oh my gosh, I would love to live in one of those. But I also wouldn't, because I would hate living with a family in those. And, you know, the pictures that made it in, like for me too, I think with all of my work, it's never really about factual documentation. Mm-hmm. I always think like, I'm trying to make films that I love with my kids as actors, right? So it's not really about their life. Yeah, yeah, it's not really about our life. It's about, you know, things we're yearning for. It's about imagination. And when I was working with The Locust specifically, I really thought about it as like a child's book. So in all my books, there's lots of things to look at. They're almost like, there's always something to find in the picture. And when I was thinking about it, I was like, well, if this was a children's book, they wouldn't always be inside. They would be inside a little bit, but you would only see like the ankles, like the peanuts, like you'd only see like the ankles of the parents.
Right.
Or you would see like a little corner of the bedroom, but they would be outside. They would be going to do these things.
Yeah.
And those times that I did photograph something inside that felt like it was something from a movie, not from my life, like those are the times that I pulled out. Because I'm always photographing, but there are certain ones you pull out that feel like, oh, this is like a still from a movie, and this is a still from a movie. And then when you put those all together, those are the ones that are kind of resonating with each other. And yeah, so like, it is hard. I'm always trying to find ways to photograph in a domestic space where I live that I find interesting. But also, like, a lot of times that we're photographing, it's because we're doing something together. So we're, you know, out looking for mushrooms, or we're camping, and it's an excuse to be doing something outside of our kind of mundane lives.
Right.
But, you know, it's... Yeah, I
think it doesn't sound like your life is very mundane.
Busy.
Yeah, busy.
I don't know if that answered your question or not.
No, it did. And actually, I sort of misspoke. I had my notes in front of me and I sort of mixed up a couple of things. It's actually not 13 pictures in where we get the interior shot. I think that's 14.
Okay, yeah. It's even farther back, probably.
13 is actually a picture that I think ties in perfectly with what you're talking about cinema. And I actually have it written down as an establishing shot, where it's actually the 13th picture is the picture of your house that we finally see from very far away. And we see the whole house with the sheep in front of it at twilight.
Yeah.
Which is a really beautiful photograph.
Oh, thanks.
And felt very much like an establishing shot in film.
Yeah.
And then we actually go inside. Yeah. So,
and that's, you know, that's really what I think about, like, all this, like, you know, when I'm, because a lot of these photos are either taken in my backyard or, like, you know, I cycle a lot. So, like, I have two cameras on my bike at all times when I'm biking. So, like, I always think of it like, if I was doing a film about my life, what would I be photographing? Like, it doesn't really matter exactly where these things are, or if they're in the, like, the, it's not photojournalism, you know? And like,
absolutely.
There was a huge freedom that came with that for me. Like, even being able like to photograph owls and stuff that like, maybe it was a 10-minute drive and an hour long hike. It's not my backyard, but like, it doesn't matter because it's the magic of cinema. Absolutely. You know?
Yeah, for sure. So let's segue from your work to your publishing.
Yeah.
And tell me about how that came about and tell folks about what you do and Charcoal Book Club.
So, you know, I had always planned on publishing books, but after publishing like a 200-page, it was basically a photo book, but it was before I even knew what photo books were. It was, you know, the magazine that I ran, you know, we would go to a location for 3 to 4 months with a team of people and actually create a 200-page book about the place. Mm-hmm. And then we would publish it and we sold copies. We were in like J.Crew and Anthropology. We sold, you know, 25,000 copies, you know, worldwide for a while. And I remember coming into discovering photo books and being like, oh, wow, these are the same thickness as the books I've been making. Mm-hmm. They sell for 3 times as much mm-hmm. and people are only selling 500 copies. Like, what's wrong with them?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Like there's people out there that will buy stuff. So I remember coming into it right off the bat, kind of with that understanding and realizing that photo books were the thing I was always trying to make. I just didn't know what they were. Mm-hmm. So when I started with that, I was like, well, I want to publish these things, but I'm really tired of having to ask for people to remember to buy them every couple months when we publish a new one. Mm-hmm. Like when we had the magazine, it was like every time subscription came up, it was like hounding people. And like, even people that loved what you do are just busy. They just forget about things. Yeah. And so I came up with the idea of Charcoal Book Club. I was like, well, it'd be great to basically build an audience that trusts curation that you're doing and only has to decide one time to support you. Mm-hmm. And then it's kind of my job not to fuck up mm-hmm. what I'm doing to make them mad and like cancel. Mm-hmm. So at the very beginning, I was like, okay, well, like I want to do this. I want to publish books, but specifically I want to publish books that I don't have to require on a big name to sell them. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to raise money through the artist to do it because like both of those things are very hard to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that was like one of my disappointments with a lot of the books I was looking at early on was like, this book is either only being published because the artist is known, the publisher knows it can sell, or the artist just brought a bunch of money to the table and the book probably should have never been published, or, you know, through a grant or something like that. So I felt like those incentive structures in publishing, specifically photo book publishing, were a little bit misaligned. And I figured if I could come to it, have a very specific vision of the books I wanted to see published, then it's basically just like being a record label or anything like that, where you're kind of curating your audience by the books you're putting out with Book Club. And like, this is like the taste, this is like the interest that we're doing. And then when we publish books, those books go right into the Book Club. But we also already have that crowdfunded money to be able to pay for the publishing and to really kind of do things the right way, where you're not like, oh, we wanted to do a great, beautiful, big hardcover, but we raised, you know, $3,000 less than what we needed. So mm-hmm. we have to do like a little book. So that was really kind of the idea behind it. Then it's just been kind of a slow build. I think Book Club's been going for like 5 years mm-hmm. at this point now. We've been publishing books for me too. Like I think each book that I publish like probably takes at least 2 years of working mm-hmm. with the artist for it. It's at least a year of me just sitting and looking at the work every day and trying to figure out what the work is. Like I really like working with people that have a big archive but don't know what they're doing with it. Mm-hmm. And I always think of it as like, I always think of myself as like a film director who's looking for a cinematographer who's been shooting B-roll for like 20 years.
Yeah.
And then we can figure out what the movie is together. Mm-hmm. And it's been really rewarding because I have something to work on every day, whether it's my work or not, that kind of scratches that itch of like puzzle building and figuring out what goes to what. And I feel like there's kind of like a little bit of a superpower that comes with it too, because it's so much easier to edit other people's work than it is your own. And when you do it enough times, you kind of start preaching to yourself about like what you need to do in your own work mm-hmm. and what you're not doing, where mm-hmm. you're screwing up. So yeah, so we have, I think, 3 books. Yeah, we'll have 3 books published this year, then kind of staying on like 3 to 4 books a year that we're publishing, which is about the max I can do.
Right.
Because, you know, doing Book Club, then doing the publishing and doing all the PR for the publishing mm-hmm. and all the sales and everything mm-hmm. like that. I think like 3 books a year is about as much as I can handle and stay sane.
That's reasonable.
But it's bad because I have so many. I have like probably like 6 or 7 on the back burner right now, just kind of slowly simmering away, trying to figure them out. So, you know, I wish I could do more, but I think.
And what you say simmering on the back burner, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Oh, no.
I'm dying of curiosity, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to. But I'm wondering, like, the artists whose projects those are, what do they think is going on?
Yeah, so I was Jack Whitty from Twin Palms was really helpful to me when I first started Charcoal. And I remember talking to him about this, and he was like, when I tell an artist I want to work with them, it might be 4 months or it might be 40 years before they hear back, and they usually get a book, and that's the next update that they get. I'm like, well, I'm not that extreme, but I do like to sit on work for a long time. And since of how we're kind of set up with Charcoal, like I do a very hands-on process with them. So some people come and they have like a good idea of what they want their book to be. There's, there's a German lady I'm working with right now who has been working on this project for, I think, like 15 years or something like that. She is very far along. So there was less building we had to do, and a lot of it was refining and trimming down and kind of like smoothing out, but that's still probably going to be about a year and a half, 2 year process before the book actually comes out. We're like getting ready to possibly start testing now. And then there's another book you never really testing. Know yeah so and then there's another book actually the next book we're publishing is going, it's at the printer right now, it's called Sealskin, and this is a good example of I literally bumped into this guy on an island in Maine, like 8 or 9 years ago. And he was like, oh, I used to have a Leica. And we just started talking, and you know, he moved to Maine in the 80s and just fell in love with it. Ended up, you know, over time becoming a fisherman, then, bought a little island to put sheep on, ended up getting married, building a house, had like 3 kids on the island. It's like an off the grid island. And the entire time he was photographing with a Leica and Kodachrome. And it's like a 30-year archive of basically a life I wish I could live, right. You know?
I didn't want to say that.
I know. It's
we were all thinking it.
Yeah. And so, but that book, I've been working on that for probably about, you know, 6 years in total of like being active, but like really figured out the kind of the narrative of it, which I tied it to an old Norse Selkie myth about the fisherman's wife, who basically this fisherman finds a Selkie, which is like a mermaid. They fall in love, they get married. But when she finds her skin one of these days, she ends up going back to her family in the ocean. It was very kind of parallel with what happened with his wife and his kids on this island. So when I discovered it was a mermaid story, you know, 2 years ago, really kind of helped focus it. But those are kind of the two opposite ends of a huge body of work that just needed to find the glue to make sense of why choosing certain images.
Right.
And then another one where I fell in love with the project right away, and it was really just kind of about like making it more flowing better, making sure that like there's not too much repetition, just trying to figure out like how to not have slow spots in the work. And then it's kind of everything in between, and kind of each artist is in a different place. There's some artists that want to be a lot more hands-on, so we go back and forth with edits a lot more. But that's usually kind of in that last like 2/3 to 1/3 of the process. Kind of the first thing is like I'm really trying to get a sense of what the work really is, because there's, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this with the artists you work with, there's always the concepts and the idea of what they're working on or trying to do when they're working on a project. And then you look at what they did and there's like, okay, well, that's what you're trying to do. This is what you actually did. And then what's that going to look like when we present it to everyone else?
Right.
So there's kind of like 3 different lives to the work.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, particularly what the artist's motivation is and might have been their guiding principles. And then what's actually being communicated to us, the viewer.
Yeah.
And those two things are
all. And some artists are more successful at doing what they're trying to do. Other people are doing something significantly better than what they were trying to do. And they just have to see what they were actually doing well. And so sometimes it's just about pulling those pieces out and kind of showing it back to them in a way that's like, you know, one of the things I notice a lot with photographers, because like editing and publishing is a very different skill set than photographing. And a lot of times photographers in their portfolios or even in their book projects, you can tell that they're pulling images based on what they were trying to do when they were shooting it. And they're not really looking at the project as a whole, or even the images that don't reference their obvious references. They like those images because they've seen them before. They're like, oh, that kind of looks like a Brian Scutma. In their head, subconsciously, they're thinking that, but they might have a photo in there that's incredibly unique, that's truly them, but they like don't have eyes to see it yet. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times it's just pulling out those pieces and showing it back to them and showing them like, this is your work. You were doing this.
Right.
You just weren't looking for it.
Right. No, often you know, the subconscious will make itself known. And actually reading, if I can't get this quote even remotely correct, then Michael will be kind enough to cut this part out.
Yeah. But, he'll dub it in.
Exactly.
With my voice.
Yeah. Doing her voice.
Just to see if people are on their toes and paying attention. Read a really brief interview the other day with a great guitarist, Bill Frisell, who I love. And he was just talking about, you know, spending his life just stealing all his favorite stuff by other musicians. Yeah. And then, you know, the end result is that when it comes out of him.
Yeah, it's always going to be different.
Then it's his voice.
Is that quote, amateurs borrow, real artists steal?
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a, I forget who said that quote, but I think it's so true. I mean, I remember early on when I was in school, you know, doing master copies, you realize that even if you're able to copy a Da Vinci or able to copy any of these artists, like your version is always different
than
theirs.
Absolutely.
And like, I always think that like the most kind of interesting or original artists are simply the ones with the most references. Mm-hmm. You know, like I tell young photographers all the time, like, hey, this looks great, but I can tell you were only looking at Alex Hoth books while you did this. Like, find four other artists you're interested in, try to copy them at the same time, then that mix is going to be uniquely you.
Yeah, which I think is sort of what Frisell was saying.
Totally, yeah, because you're always going to interpret it a different way.
Absolutely. No, I'm all in favor of reference, and as people who listen to the show know, because I say it all the time, but I think it's a wonderful tool, frankly. Yeah. I mean, it just is. And, it, you know, we love it in so many other mediums, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't, you know, remember the last time I read a review of a film that a critic was gushing about where there wasn't some reference to the filmmaker of this film paying homage to some other filmmaker at some point in the film. I mean, it's like,
and even if you are trying not to do it, it still seeps in, like that subconscious, like we were talking about. I did an Instagram post the other day. I was looking through one of my favorite etchings from William Blake is this etching of this little girl with her knees up, and there's this big earthworm going over her, and it's really bizarre image. And I remember, like, I've had that thing saved on, like, my phone. I've printed it out a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And then I had a picture in my new book, In the Seraphim, that I was looking. I was like, oh, my God, this is the same image. Mm-hmm. Like, I never meant to do it. And, like, I actually think I discovered it after I took the picture.
Right.
But everything down to in the William Blake, there's, like, a woman's face coming up out of the grave. And in my picture, it's my son holding a coyote's head on the ground. It's like, this is bizarre. Like even without trying to make an obvious reference, like you just like, it's just who we are as human beings.
You're
there's nothing
a
new
conversation. It's like, it's, I think it's really,
it's all in the soup.
Yeah,
it's all in the soup.
So I want to talk about Chico because I'm still recovering.
Yeah. Either you're having withdrawal or you're having recovery.
I'm in recovery. You know, it's a really incredible event. So it's a week in Pray.
Yeah, Livingston area.
Livingston area of Montana at an old, I don't know what to call it, honestly, because people were asking me, like, is it a resort? And I was like, not really.
Yeah, technically it's a resort, but it's like a local Montanan resort.
Yeah, you can't call it a resort. No. It gives really the wrong idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's its own thing.
Yeah.
So I think most importantly, there's about 60 to 70 participants who are not only having their work reviewed over the course of a week, well, 4 or 5 days, but they're also participating in, and I use the word participating because they're at these artist talks, but there's a lot of Q&A. It's extremely warm and connected between, in general, between the people who are participating and who have paid money to be there and the folks who come to review the work and or give artist talks.
Yeah.
And there's also an element of photo bookmaking workshops that go on, all in this location where, for the most part, we're sort of all together, which is why I call it camp.
Yeah.
I mean, it has, and where, you know, when I do reviews that are in cities, you sort of can just go off on your own all the time. Here, where
you can't,
for better or worse, I may have referred to myself as a hostage once or twice, but no, I mean, you know, you and I sort of joked about, like, you know, my experience there, and I had an incredible experience. It was tough because it's a long time. There's an off day or two sort of built in, and you know, you really want us all there together, learning about one another. You don't want it to be sort of 3 days in and 3 days out. No, so so tell us about this insane thing that, because there's also about 30, it's almost like 2-to-1 participants to reviewers.
So, it's, I think the math is like, for every reviewer, there's 4 attendees. So it's like a 1-to-4 ratio, I think.
It felt like
It might be. Yeah. Well, I think now that we have like our alumni program and we also have our staff and all that, it's definitely more. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I built it because I wanted it to be a relationship builder. Mm-hmm. And you can't do relationship quickly. You know, that those are all speed dating. And I think the thing that I realized pretty early on in like when I was an illustrator is that success in a lot of industries in general, but specifically the art world, is about relationships. And people say that in a bad way, where it's like, oh, it's all about who you know. It's like, yeah, but you have to know people. And and that's a good thing, because it also is kind of about who you are as a human. It's your work is like the thing that gets your foot in the door and gets you recognized, but kind of the rest of your success in a field really depends on, you know, are you a good person? Do you come through for people? Like, can people trust you? You know, kind of all that. And so, you know,
Do people want to work with you?
Yeah. I mean, I remember that as an illustrator, is like my clients would call me because someone bailed on the illustration. They needed it overnight. They needed it tomorrow. And they knew that I would stay up for them all night. And they knew I'd be in a good mood. You know? So I think that kind of comes through. And for me, a lot of the things I build, whether it's charcoal or, you know, the Chico review, is really to kind of fill a void that I feel in my own life. And I've always felt very isolated, because I'm always kind of coming to the art world from the outside. Like, I didn't go to traditional art school. I'm kind of always finding back doors into things. And for me, I was like, well, I want to do this kind of networking that I always thought of as being like what MFA programs were supposed to be, or even like the way that New York used to be in the 80s, where you would bump into people at the bar because you kind of all lived in the same area. I was so disappointed that that isn't really the way the art world is anymore. And so it was kind of like, well, I can still build that, and it can be 1 week out of the year, and it can be really purposeful, and you can build it in a way that guarantees those kind of experiences happening. Because I think a lot of times, even in Chico, it's like if people had the opportunity to isolate or to go off on their own, they would, but you don't have the option. And so you're forced to doing the thing you actually should do, but maybe you don't want to do, you're too shy to do, but you're always glad you did it when you leave.
No, I think that that's I think that's really true. It's like, I'm not very extroverted in groups. I'm very social in small groups, and very, you know, happy to, you know, one-on-one and whatever. But the bigger the group, the quieter I get. That's, I think there are a lot of folks like me, but, so, you know, these types of things are difficult for me. And I just, speaking for myself, I really had to push myself. And I'm the reviewer. I'm the professional, right? So I'm very sympathetic and really connected to what you're saying now, because I'm sure I know there were many participants who are like me and had to just push through it the way I pushed through it.
Exactly.
You know, I made it through every single dinner with colleagues. I may have been the first one to leave, but I never left before dessert. Even though Brian Skipmott felt the need to announce when I was leaving the dining room every single evening. But not getting away with my Irish goodbye, as they call it. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Yeah, he's good at calling people out.
Yeah. No, but it was really, I mean, you know, I had incredible conversations with people, and really moving and meaningful moments. And
it's one of the reasons that even with the attendees, like, there, you know, every year we get the same questions, like, you know, like, I bring specific reviewers at times that they aren't big draws, but I know that they're people that will blow people away when they leave. And I always think of it as like, they give people what they think they want, but also what they need.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, that's the formula. Right, and it's, I always think of it like, almost like I'm just doing a music festival. Like my job is like to have good headliners, and that brings in people that feel it's worth to pay the expense. But you, if you're a good concert builder, then you're going to, you know, have great sideshow right. acts that no one's ever heard of before. And right. people leave like, how the hell did I not know of that person?
Right. Totally.
And I think that like that kind of mindset and that whole experience, cause yeah, every year people are like, oh, I wish it was cheaper or I wish it was shorter. It's like, yeah, but it wouldn't be this event.
Right.
It was those things. Right. And I think that knowing what that purpose is to really build deep friendships through a shared experience.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's why people cry when they leave camp after 1 week,
yeah.
you know?
It's yeah, we're like, there for 8 days yeah, together, and that yeah. is nonstop.
Yeah.
So that is...
And, you know, and that's grown. Intense. The first year we ever did it, we actually, the entire thing was 4 days long from, like, travel days and
wow.
everything.
Yeah.
And it was not a good idea.
Right.
And yeah. then the next year we added travel days, and then that's when we realized we need a break in the middle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we added a break day. And, you know, kind of every year I'm just kind of... adding to it or, mm-hmm. or cutting away of like what is too much or what isn't enough to really kind of find that perfect yeah. balance of like, you know,
no, it's good. It's so thoughtful. It's really beautiful. I mean, you know, I hope and I'm sure you hope this, the time comes when there can be a lot of, you know, scholarships because it is very yeah. expensive.
Yeah.
I do believe that there's an importance to really, you know, having to save and
yeah.
you know, we all have to prioritize and save for the things that, you know, unless we have trust funds, which none of us do here in this room.
Right. I have a trust fall. That's about it. I mean, what you're saying, like,
so it's yeah. important to have to strive and whatnot,
yeah.
but there are people for whom no matter what, they wouldn't be able to afford Chico because it is.
Yeah.
Every you take care of it's every
it's
meal
yeah,
it's
booze,
all
everything
so it's a lot and you know it'd be great to maybe we'll brainstorm together
yeah you know we give away 6 scholarships every year out of our you know basically the profit of the event. Those are the big ones. Then we give we have like need-based scholarships that we give out too that are based on like how many applications we get.
Mm-hmm.
So I think every year, just the event itself, we give out like something like $30,000 or $40,000 worth of it.
Wow, that's great.
But it yeah. sucks because it's like it's never enough. But
right.
it's also like a huge chunk of profit that we could be using
yeah,
for something
no,
else.
No.
But it's worth it. But also like what you're saying, it is so important that people have something at risk.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's really important for what people feel like they can get out of it. Because we used to give out more scholarships, like more full rides. And I ended up feeling that a lot of times that the people who are coming on a full ride weren't really fully take, like they would like miss lectures.
Right.
And
like not as terrified.
Yeah.
To, like,
and it's like, I think yeah. I like the idea of people have like everyone has something invested.
Right.
You know? And yeah, I think that over time, like, and we've had past attendees, like, gift a scholarship to someone, and we've always done it like on the kind of down low because
yeah.
I like the idea of like being able to do stuff that we're not even like over delivering for people,
right?
Like not even announcing that we're giving a special scholarship. It's like
right.
you know this
right.
person really wanted this kind of person to come, so if we see that person in our applications, like
yep.
we're just going to give it to them, and
right.
we're not going
right.
to
That's
like
awesome.
Announce it, we're not going to make a big
yep.
deal about it, but like this is something that a past attendee wanted to be a part of.
Right.
That's, and it's like, it feels
wonderful.
Really cool to be able to do it like
yep.
on the sly.
Yeah, no, totally. No, I get that. Well, I know you and I could keep talking, which is good that we're going out to dinner later.
Yeah.
So, but sorry for all you folks listening that you won't be at the dinner. Maybe
yeah.
I'll record the dinner. And it'll just
well, We also have talked many hours on Michael's podcast. So
yeah, right.
If there's any
right.
blanks that need
yep,
filled
yep.
in.
Okay, good. That's right. Jesse, thank you so much for spending time with us today, and it's really wonderful.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming to Chico. I mean, it's been such a pleasure to get to know you and to know MCD over here. And so yeah, it's been fantastic, and I love what you're doing with the podcast and everything. So
thank you so much. All right, be well. See you later.
Goodbye.
Photo Work with Sasha Wolf is a production of the Photo Work Foundation. Executive producer is Sasha Wolf, and the associate producer is Taylor Selsback. The show is also produced and edited by me, Michael Chauvin Dalton of Real Photo Show. Music is by J. Walter Hawks. If you like the show and wish to find out more about the foundation, please visit photowork.foundation and be sure to subscribe and review with all the stars on your listening platform.